Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I'm a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. We've recently revamped the Radio In Vivo website, so we hope you will check that out. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Well, since the ancient Greeks, poets and philosophers have been telling us, "Know thyself." But it's doubtful that they had our genomes in mind. Today, a few very select people know themselves more intimately than the ancients could ever have imagined. And some of them have gone public with that self-knowledge, making their entire genomic sequences of 6 billion base pairs available for one and all to see. My guest on Radio In Vivo this week, Dr. Misha Angrist from Duke University, is one of those rare individuals who has had his genome sequenced. And he wrote a remarkable book about that remarkable experience. It's called Here is a Human Being at the Dawn of Personal Genomics. We'll spend much of the hour talking about the book and Misha's experiences. Misha was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He is assistant professor of the practice at Duke University Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy, and he is a visiting lecturer at the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy inside Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy. He received his PhD in genetics from Case Western Reserve University and was formerly a board-eligible genetic counselor. He also received an MFA in writing and literature from the Bennington Writing Seminars. He is a past winner of the Brenda L. Smart Fiction Prize and was nominated for the Pushcart Prize. In 2007, he became the fourth subject of the Personal Genome Project, which was led by Harvard geneticist George Church. Misha, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thanks, Ernie. It's great to be here.
I want to start out by just telling you right out front, I loved your book. Totally enjoyed it.
Well, thanks very much.
It's a fascinating story about high-level science, which obviously is of great interest, but it's populated by very colorful characters and a very impressive level, I must say, of autobiographical revelation. I mean, it's one thing to put your genome out there, but you've invited the reader to know you on a very intimate level. It makes for a great story, along with the important information you include and the important issues that you bring up, which we will delve into in some detail. That being said, I would like to start out by having you just tell us a little bit about the Personal Genome Project, or PGP, itself. What is or was it, and how does it fit into the wider context of the field of contemporary genomics?
So As you mentioned, the Personal Genome Project was started by Harvard geneticist George Church, who I think really began to articulate it in 2003 or 2004 when he wrote a grant proposal that aimed to begin to sequence, that is, decode the DNA of a large number of healthy people.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that time, we had the Human Genome Project, which was essentially a consensus genome, and it was the consensus of essentially several people from Buffalo, New York, who have remained anonymous. And it was a haploid genome, meaning that it did not try to parse which fraction of the DNA came from the mother and which came from the father. So it had some limitations. And George Church had been pretty much devoted his career to thinking about DNA sequencing and faster and better and cheaper ways to do it. And I think the Personal Genome Project was, in a way, sort of a coming out party, sort of a way to say, okay, let's start doing this, and let's try to do it at a reasonable cost. And let's try to think about what we're going to do with the information once we have it. And I think as he thought about that and he began wading into matters of informed consent and how identifiable DNA is, because unless you're an identical twin, it's pretty much unique to you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he said, why can't we recruit a cohort of people who are willing to simply make their information public and understand the risk of making genetic information public, and let's make that information available to as many people, particularly people in the research community, as we possibly can. So that was the idea. And when he proposed that most publicly in an article in Scientific American in January 2006, my sense is it was met with sort of a deafening silence. People like the idea, in the science community anyway, people like the idea of fast, cheap DNA sequencing, but they were, and to some extent, to a large extent, I would say, are not comfortable with the idea of people putting their genomes on the internet.
Sure, since it flies in the face of, you know, the tenets of privacy and, you know, keeping information to yourself, even scientifically.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So what was, I mean, this was all kind of wrapped up with the open source movement at the same time, right?
Absolutely. So George Church actually went to Duke as an undergraduate and has told me stories. He's come to visit me at Duke and has, you know, pointed at a building and said, you know, I used to sit in the basement there with the IBM punch cards. So he was a very early adopter and participant in computer programming, particularly with science, doing science as the goal. And he was very inspired by the open source software movement, and he was very uninspired by the way DNA sequencing took shape as an industry in the 1980s and 1990s, where essentially there was one company, Applied Biosystems, that was sort of the Microsoft, the 800-pound gorilla of DNA sequencing, was able to charge monopoly prices. And if you wanted to do DNA sequencing on any large scale, or what was large scale for the time, then you had to use ABI equipment and ABI reagents, ABI chemicals.
Mm-hmm. Now, he actually developed a lot of his own sequencing equipment, didn't he?
Yes, he has. So to go back in time, when he went to Harvard in the 70s for graduate school, this is after he had flunked out of graduate school at Duke for never going to class.
That would do it.
When he comes down here to give talks, he always puts up a slide of the letter he got from the dean telling him his services were no longer needed. So he was in a guy named Walter Gilbert's lab, and Walter Gilbert shared the Nobel Prize in 1980 for inventing a way to decode the DNA sequence. I'm sorry, I forget what your original question was.
About his inventing some of the equipment.
Oh, yes. So he, in parallel to his thoughts about answering scientific questions and sharing information openly, he's always been an inventor. He's always been a technology developer. He's always been a better, cheaper mousetrap kind of guy. And so to that end, he developed a technology that I won't try to describe in any detail.
Sure.
In the early 2000s, that was subsequently licensed, ironically enough, by a company that was sold to Applied Biosystems and is now part of Life Technologies, yet a bigger company involved in this space. So I got to see that up close, and I think for all of it, you know, I'm just coming back from the Genomes, Environments, and Traits conference that he hosts every year, and this is the first year that personal genome participants were invited en masse.
Mm-hmm. And there were 10 originally.
There were 10 originally, mm-hmm. Yes. And it's always a reminder of how difficult this stuff is, that it's not like buying a Kindle or an iPad and you open up the box and it works seamlessly and beautifully. And George sort of takes pride, I would say, in failing publicly.
Many of us do that, Misha.
Yes, but not many of us, I would say, are as comfortable with it as he is.
Indeed.
So I'm not saying that his sequencing technology has been a public failure. I would say simply that there have been a lot of bumps, and he's now, I think, outsourced most of it to a company called Danaher.
I see.
That is selling these machines at quite a discount, actually, to the new 800-pound gorillas, notably Illumina.
Well, it's you know, as you described, there's been a lot of bumps in the road, not only for George Church, but for the whole industry, really, in terms of making progress. But that being said, remarkable progress has been made. Are we not getting ready to finally hit the $1,000 genome?
I think we are. I'm a little wary of making predictions because I think I've predicted a $1,000 genome in 2010 and 2011. We're somewhere around the $3,000 or $4,000 genome now, depending on where you get your genome and how you count parts and labor and whether you're buying in bulk or not. But certainly wholesale genomes are $4,000 or in that range. And everybody in the field now likes to show this slide that shows the cost of genome sequencing essentially falling off a cliff beginning in 2005, 2006, and picking up speed in subsequent years. And I think there's no question it's a race to the bottom, and I think there's no question that George Church belongs in the Sequencing Hall of Fame and has a lot to do with that precipitous decline in price. That said, I think the real bottleneck now is figuring out what those genomes mean, what all that DNA sequence information means.
Sure.
And I think that's going to be a much tougher slog.
Mm-hmm, indeed. We'll come back to that major question in a little bit. But before we get there, I want to kind of talk about a little bit more about the PGP and your own involvement in it. Now, you were, of that initial 10, you were subject number 4, correct?
Yes, I was.
Now, how did you come to decide to even be interested in it, let alone make that decision to actually participate? Because that's a huge, huge decision.
I guess maybe at the time it was a huge decision. It seems now, knowing that there are 1,600 or 1,700 other people who are fully enrolled, it seems like less of a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me, reading that Scientific American article and spending many hours talking to George Church, it was a real sort of light bulb moment for me.
Sure.
In the sense of someone who had gone to graduate school and spent a lot of time in a lab analyzing human DNA samples and always feeling this strange kind of disconnected feeling between what I was doing and the people who had actually donated their samples and information. And George Church, I think, was really unique and was really the first one to say that this disconnect is artificial and it doesn't have to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is something that, I mean, he has many compelling traits, but I think one that really got me was his willingness to just sort of throw out all preconceptions and to sort of re-derive the way science should be done. And if our goal was X, what is the best way to get there? So, for example, I remember interviewing one of his postdocs, and I said, what's it like to be a Church trainee? What is it like to interact with him? And he said, well, I will go into his office and I will say, I am trying to do this, and here are the 10 steps I need to do, it seems to me, before I can get there. And he will say, well, why don't you simply skip those and just go right to 9 or 10?
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a real ingenuous quality, a real feeling of anything is possible. It's kind of a West Coast utopian vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's what makes him so compelling and so respected and also scares people and maybe alienates them and they don't understand him.
Sure. Well, I mean, he was willing to kind of put his money where his mouth was because he was subject number one.
Yes, he was.
Right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's you say that in retrospect it doesn't seem like that big a deal, but I'm sure at the time, and for most people even right now, regardless of how many participants there are, it's a pretty big deal to put your own genome out there in public. You know, I know that from your description in the book, your wife was very much involved in the decision-making process, and you thought about, you have two daughters, and you thought about the potential impact on them of having your genome, which obviously would impart some information about them, out there. So what was that like? Because I know it wasn't an overnight snap decision, although you had committed pretty early on.
No, it wasn't. My family has been extraordinarily tolerant of a lot of things I do. You know, again, I think we make choices about things that we want to share and things that we don't want to share. And early in the book, I quote a bioethicist from Stanford named Hank Greeley, who says, you know, I would guess that my credit card receipts say more about my true being than my genome does.
Mm-hmm. Or your internet history.
Right. Sure. And I couldn't agree more.
Uh-huh.
And I think people get confused. They conflate a willingness to share genetic information with a willingness to live their entire lives in public. You know, there's a famous story, I think it was written about in the New Yorker, about this guy who just wore a camera 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
And for all I know, he's still wearing it. And documenting every single moment of his life. And for me, that's not what this is about. I'm not really interested in sharing my email or, you know, my correspondence or my telephone conversations or whatever it is. But I do think genetic information is wrongly held up as something so powerful and so intimate and so uniquely subject to misuse and evil.
Mm-hmm.
And so people say, well, you know, you make your genome public and your daughters share 50% of that, and what about them? And I suppose my response is I think to sort of give in to that is to concede that this information really is
determinative.
Yeah, deterministic. Mm-hmm. It is something. It is destiny.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I, in my heart of hearts, I do not believe that. And part of my mission, I suppose, if that's not too grandiose, is to demystify it. You know, there's been a lot of hand-wringing about whether genetic testing of children at all is a good idea. And I think, you know, those are questions that we don't ask about other medical information and medical procedures. I'm much less hung up about it than I was.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you know, if someone doesn't want to do that, or if someone believes I don't want to reveal anything about my genetic information or my family's genetic information, because I don't think it's fair to them, I respect that.
Sure.
That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I say is, you know, this is much more about your family and your relationship with your biological family than it is about some intrinsic quality of the information, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. I know that given what you've said, you still had some struggles, as you describe in the book, with the decisions to whether to make your entire genome, or even to get it yourself. The possibility was there to redact some of the material.
Yes.
And that was a very interesting discussion. But ultimately, you decided, even in the case of Alzheimer's disease or breast cancer mutations,
right,
you decided to go ahead and get that material, which was very, very interesting. Many of the other folks said, yeah, just bring it on. But you had some good reasons to ponder
on
that.
Again, I think the distinction is, I don't think anybody should be cavalier about it, whatever they decide ultimately to do or not do. So, I have a family history of early onset breast cancer, which is more likely to be determined by a single gene. My mother was diagnosed with it in her 40s. She's of Ashkenazi Jewish descent. So there's a decent chance that she carries a mutation in one of the known breast cancer genes, which I'm male. It's unlikely that I would develop breast cancer, though not impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But I could transmit that mutation to my daughters.
Sure.
And so the question was, is that something that I want to make public? And so my wife and I talked about it, and I think, you know, in the end, the decision was not that we didn't want them to know, but we wanted them to find out from us,
mm-hmm.
not from somebody surfing the web and saying, aha.
Right.
Here's a mutation in BRCA1. I wonder if Misha passed that on to his kids.
Mm-hmm. Which we should make clear, as it ultimately turned out, you did not have those mutations.
That's
right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just wrote this on my blog, in fact, yesterday. That was a moment of great relief.
Sure. Absolutely. Certainly would be, because that is potentially a more deterministic outcome.
Right. Yes. And I don't want to minimize that. So, you know, I still have a foot in the sort of conventional clinical genetics world, and I have a lot of friends in that world. And I don't think we can minimize what those families with strongly deterministic mutations go through.
Mm-hmm.
I have a genetic counselor friend who just this week is seeing a rather awful and tragic case. And, you know, I don't think any of the other stuff that's going on should somehow dilute or minimize what happens in a genetics clinic,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Absolutely, it does. But I understand that part of the scientific impetus for doing the PGP was to start filling in kind of the picture, because I think one thing that's been determined over the last several years in the genome-wide association studies is that there's so much still to learn about the genome and what's going on with it and how, if at all, those combinations can cause disease, along, of course, with environmental interactions. Yeah, that the single gene diseases are mostly, thank goodness, pretty uncommon, if not extremely rare. So it seems that the field has shifted to try to find that so-called missing heritability.
Yeah, well, so this was one of the grand ambitions and hopes of the Human Genome Project was let's find out the genetic basis of type 2 diabetes or Crohn's disease. Or why some people are tall and some people are short. And unfortunately, what we found out is humans are not like dogs. And what I mean by that is dogs, in addition to being awesome, I'm a dog person, they have genomes that are very amenable to analysis of complex traits, whether, you know, it's diseases like German shepherds getting hip dysplasia or behaviors, you know, why do some dogs herd and bark and that sort of thing. And so dogs tend to have few genes of large effect that determine those sorts of traits. Humans tend to have many, many genes of small effect that determine those kinds of traits. And the reason is we have been very... we have left this huge fingerprint on the evolution of the dog by selecting for those traits. And so we have, in a relatively short period of time, in some cases just a few generations, we have selected for dogs that have behaviors and traits, you know, whether it's herding or wrinkly skin, traits that we want for whatever reason.
Sure.
And so that has left the dog genome much more amenable to those sorts of analyses than the human genome, which in general, as I said in this article that appeared on the internet yesterday, a total effing mess, because we are outbred, because we don't select for traits. We don't breed humans to be, you know, good at math or whatever it is.
Yet.
Okay.
Well, that's very interesting. So, where does that go though?
So, or is this the inevitable Gattaca question?
as you wish.
Well, I think it's scientifically and technologically impossible, basically, to imagine a purely genetic screen for height, to simply say, I am going to choose an embryo that has these 4,000 variants so that my kid can play in the NBA.
That's still science fiction at this point.
It is. Yeah. And it's just so much easier to start out being tall and to marry someone else tall.
Indeed.
So... I'm not too worried about that. I think what we are going to see, and to some extent have seen already, is selection against fetuses with various genetic diseases.
Sure.
So we're getting to be really good at that.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability to sequence an entire genome, or what we call an exome, that is the 2% of the genome that actually codes for protein,
mm-hmm.
and to screen out fertilized eggs that carry mutations for those kinds of conventional single gene disorders that mm-hmm. tend to be severe and often horrifying and expensive.
Sure.
I think that that is probably inevitable.
Mm-hmm. I understand the latest technological development in that realm is the ability to perform screening and sequencing on fetal DNA extracted from the mother's blood.
Yes. In fact, there's now a commercial product that is designed to do just that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's still fairly early days, and I would be a bit skeptical. But that said, I do think that that is inevitable. And so what does that mean? Well, that means instead of having an invasive procedure like amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling that involve large needles,
mm-hmm.
Screening a pregnancy for deleterious mutations becomes just another blood test.
Sure.
And so that sort of lowers the bar for getting that information, and then what decisions do women and families make once they have that information? And we know from Down syndrome and other chromosomal abnormalities that most women choose to terminate those pregnancies. And so that does raise the question of how do we then treat people who make the other choice and mm-hmm. decide mm-hmm. to continue their pregnancies? And how do we treat those people in a world where they become increasingly rare?
Indeed. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Misha Angrist from the Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy at Duke University. He is the author of Here Is a Human Being at the Dawn of Personal Genomics. And Misha, let's get back to Misha for a minute, since we potentially know so much about you. You know, ultimately, I understand that it actually took a good little while for this all to happen in terms of getting your genome sequenced. It was about a 3-year process, I understand.
Yeah.
Once it was all in your hands, what did you learn about the Misha Angrist genome?
Mm. That's a good question. And I'm always wary I don't want to disappoint people with the answer. But I think in general, you know, I'm pretty healthy. I could stand to lose some weight, and I have a family history of heart disease. And so my genome confirmed that I do indeed carry some of those hereditary risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly the stuff that I learned tends to fall on the margins. Like everyone, I do carry mutations for rare recessive diseases. I am done having children, so that's much less of a concern. It's possible that I passed those mutations on to my daughters, and when the time comes, I imagine they will get sequenced. They won't need to ask me either for permission or really, it'll be a blood test, I imagine, in 10 years or whenever.
Mm-hmm.
if not sooner. So the stuff I tended to learn was stuff that is useful at the margins. If I ever need a blood thinner, if I have thrombosis, I will need a special dose of warfarin, the most commonly prescribed blood thinner. I learned something about my ancestry, which tends to comport fairly well with what I know about my family. Mm-hmm. So that's of interest. And then, you know, the rest is probably falls in the category of geekdom. That is, seeing that I have certain mutations that probably should have killed me in the womb. And we're seeing quite a bit of this now. And this is one of the things that has come out of the Personal Genome Project is our genomes are all housed in a database that is curated by mostly by a woman named Madeline Ball in the church lab at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And she talks about this, you know, that she goes through whatever they have, the 60 or 70 public genomes, and she looks for quote-unquote scary stuff. Inevitably, she finds it, but then she starts digging. And so digging involves combing through the literature and saying, okay, so this mutation has been seen in a case of disease X. Is it really causative of that disease? And quite often the answer turns out to be no, mm-hmm. or at the very least, we have no idea.
Right.
So that's one thing. And then at the same time, you know, if the that genome is identifiable, that is, if we know who it is, because some of the public genomes are of research samples whose identity we don't know.
Okay.
But mm-hmm. if she can go back to the person and say, do you have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy in your family? The person can either say, yes, in fact, my father has it or my cousin has it. Or they can say, absolutely not. I just had an EKG or whatever, mm-hmm. and my heart looks great.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, you say you, along with everybody else, has some of these rare mutations. And in the book, you write that, and I thought this was quite profound, that eventually all of us are the numerator, the one in something, and that one of the promises of personal genomics is that it will tell us exactly what we're at risk for being the numerator for, but that we all have something like that, which really flies in the face of worrying about insurance discrimination was one thing I thought about.
Right. Well,
because they can't say no to everybody. They wouldn't have a business, right?
You would hope so. This is one of the things. Actually, I'm giving a final exam tonight, and I will tell you, if any of my students are listening, here's a freebie. There's a question on there that says, Canadians and Europeans should be less worried about discrimination, genetic discrimination, than Americans. And the answer is true. And the simple reason is that they have universal health insurance. So there are no pre-existing conditions. If right. you get mm-hmm. sick, you go to the National Health Service or whatever, and someone takes care of you. You may opt for additional private coverage. If you're Canadian, you may choose to come to the U.S. to see a cancer specialist. But the bottom line is, you have healthcare is a right in those places.
You cannot be denied treatment.
Right.
For and any reason.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so there was actually an essay in a scholarly journal that came out a year or two ago that in very lucid terms made the argument that if you support legislation to combat genetic discrimination, which we now have, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act that President Bush signed in 2008 after 12 years.
AKA GINA.
Yes. If you support GINA, then you essentially support universal health care because you are subscribing to the idea that whatever you bring to the table in terms of heredity should not deny you the ability to get treated. And I'm don't really think of myself as a flaming socialist, but I think that that's kind of a no-brainer. And there's so much detritus and waste and insanity in our healthcare system. I guess it's like our genomes in a way.
An effing mess.
Yeah, exactly.
Indeed. Well, Misha, I want to ask you about kind of the PGP in retrospect and your involvement with it. And, you know, you've described what you learned about your genome and all that. But looking back, any second thoughts, any regrets? Would you do it again?
I would do it again. I think, if anything, I'm more passionate about what the PGP stands for. Mm-hmm. So I know before we went on the air, you and I were talking about how we are both on institutional review boards.
Right.
I'm on the Duke one, and you're on the one at UNC. And I think we share a frustration with the way that system works, the way research with human participants is evaluated and adjudicated and approved or not approved. And I think the PGP holds the promise of circumventing a lot of that stuff. Now, that's not to say, again, that it's a panacea, that it's for everyone. But I think this is another dysfunctional system. That is, I think IRBs, in my experience, without exception, they mean well. They are groups of people who are giving of their time and expertise. Mm-hmm. They get no compensation. And in fact, mostly, I can only speak for myself, I enjoy going to the meetings, I enjoy my colleagues, but much of the process is really migraine provoking. I don't know how you feel.
It can be that way.
It's
a struggle to stay awake sometimes.
Yeah, and so it's I don't see how anyone who has served on an IRB and has really thought about this kind of stuff could say with a straight face, this is it. There is no better way. And I'm not saying that the PGP is the better way. I'm saying it is another way. And I think it's another way that is likely to be instructive for the way most of the rest of the world does things.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, in my experience, it seems like the trend is almost in the opposite direction with HIPAA and everything else, and that, you know, there's a very high emphasis on privacy, data security, issues like that.
Yes. Yes.
So it's not an open source process.
Right. So all. I would argue that this is really about a river in Egypt. I think that the human research protections industrial complex is in denial. Mm-hmm. I saw this at a conference the other day. In fact, one of the medical writers from my own IRB asked a question of someone who was talking about human subjects research and social media and protecting participants in the digital age and all of this stuff. And she very astutely observed, your consent forms are saying all of this stuff about how my information will be kept in a locked filing cabinet. But it's very likely that I'm going to go on Facebook or Twitter or patients like me, and I am going to complain about my symptoms or my chemo or my allergic reaction or whatever it is. I just think it's a matter of time that the unfortunate truth, in my opinion, is that human research protections industrial complex is going to be overtaken by reality, if it hasn't already. So there was an initiative of what's called an advanced notice of proposed rulemaking that came out of the executive branch last year, saying, let's reform the way we govern this type of research with human beings. And in essence, what it says is, let's just beef up privacy. Let's just, triple encrypt everything and we'll be good to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really a shame, because I think what that does is it simply reinforces the status quo. Instead of changing the culture, instead of saying, how can we involve research participants in the process from the ground up? How can we develop a partnership with them? We are saying, how can we continue to treat them like children and dehumanize and de-identify them? So that's one of many soapboxes I like to stand on.
And that's a good soapbox, and I could not agree with you more. It's going to be very interesting to watch those trends as they evolve, because there are some certainly conflicting things going on and progressions. So we will keep an eye on that. Well, Misha, the hour has just absolutely flown by. We're just about out of time. I didn't get to half of the questions I had for you. We were going to spend some time on informed consent issues and the whole field of personal genomics.
Don't get me started.
Yeah, well, we'll have to just do this again. Maybe I'll book us out for 2 hours next
time.
But it's been great, and I certainly want to thank you for being my guest on Radio in Vivo today.
Thanks so much.
And we've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio in Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows. And we are on Facebook, so we do invite you to become a fan and stay up to date. Join us again next time for Radio in Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carborough and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we do ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. And one great way to do that is to log on to the WCOM website. That's at WCOMFM.org. Click on the Donate Now button and get the details on how to make a small monthly contribution and join our Less Than a Latte Club. For less than just the cost of one latte per week, you can help keep this independent voice of the community on the air. And now be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows here on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Catch you next time.